Oh, thank you for joining us today. I'm with Rebecca Warder and Craig Tevendale, both of Herbert Smith Freehills. And my two guest experts are looking at the quite dramatic changes in part to the 2020 arbitration regime. Arbitration is something that's always been out there, but it is attracting much attention at the moment because in 2021, when Brexit really does kick in, there is concern about the enforcement of awards in other jurisdictions. Arbitration awards are much easier to enforce because we already have the infrastructure there, and the law is not going to be changed or affected by Brexiteria. So with that, I pass over to Rebecca to introduce our topic and to get us underway today. Thank you.
The new LCA rules were published in August 2020 and are going to be applying to LCIA arbitrations commenced on or after the 1st of October 2020. So where LCIA arbitrations are already in progress before the 1st of October 2020, the LCIA rules 2014 will obviously continue to apply. And so the two sets of rules are effectively going to be running in parallel for a few years to come. So in today's session, Craig and I will be taking a look at the key changes introduced by the 2020 rules, how these provisions differ from the 2014 rules, and what those changes will mean to all of us. So moving on to our first slide, we'll be taking a detailed look at the key changes, addressing in turn electronic communications and virtual hearings, tribunal secretaries, authorised representatives, nationality, composite requests and responses, consolidation, wide tribunal discretion. Then moving on to the following slide, we're going to be covering summary dismissal, emergency arbitrator powers, interim relief, changes to timescales, data protection and cybersecurity, confidentiality, compliance, costs, and the interpretation of the rules. And after all of that, we're going to finish up by looking at how the new rules have been received so far by the international arbitration community. So Craig, shall we start off by looking at the new rules as a whole before we move on to looking at some of the important new provisions?
Yes, and let's set the scene on the next slide. The LCIA have made clear that this is not intended to be a complete reworking of the rules, and the LCIA rules 2020 are by no means a wholesale rewrite. Instead, this new edition of the rules is an update of the existing 2014 LCIA rules, and it holds true to the long-standing lean and light touch approach taken in the LCIA rules. So the LCIA have said that the changes are more of the nature of an update, but they've also rationalised some elements of the text in the interests of clarity. But having said that, there are some important changes in the new rules, and all arbitration lawyers will wish to be aware of them.
Yes, I agree. And to summarise some of those key points, the rules have certainly been modernised in recognition of the reality of the way that modern international arbitration is now being conducted. So under the 2020 rules, the parties are required to submit their documents electronically unless the LCIA or the tribunal have either approved or ordered hard copy. And very topically, in light of the recent changes to practice which have been driven by the COVID-19 pandemic, the new rules also include wording expressly allowing the tribunal the discretion to hold a virtual hearing. So in the interest of efficiency, the LCIA rules 2020 now provide for the use of so-called composite requests and composite responses, where you've got multiple related arbitrations. There are new consolidation and concurrency provisions in the 2020 rules, which are broader and more flexible than the more restrictive position on consolidation which you had under the 2014 rules. The rules now set out with increased clarity what's encompassed in that very wide discretion that an LCIA tribunal has to discharge its duties, with the rules expressly setting out a far fuller list of the tribunal's powers. There's also an early determination provision in the new rules which now expressly state for the first time that the tribunal has that right to summarily dismiss claims, defences or counterclaims. And the new rules also try to address issues in relation to the availability of interim relief, which came up in the case of Gerald Metals, and some timescales have also been shortened. There are new provisions relating to the importance of measures to protect information security and personal data. The treatment of parties' payment on the advance of costs has changed, and that's primarily in the interest of administrative simplicity.
And in addition to those specific changes, the wording of the 2020 rules has been updated throughout to clarify and produce a clearer text. For example, the confusing use of the term cross-claim, which appeared in the 2014 rules to cover both counterclaims and cross-claims against co-respondents, has been avoided. The 2020 rules use the terminology of counterclaims for claims made by respondents against claimants, and cross-claims for claims against co-respondents, which is more consistent with practitioner expectations. The new rules also contain a clearer division of the roles between parties, authorised representatives, the registrar, the LCIA court, the tribunal, and the tribunal secretary. And there is more guidance on a number of other areas, including correspondence between the different stakeholders. But now that we've looked at the new rules in the round, we should move on to focus on some of these most important changes. Rebecca, can you please take us through electronic communications and virtual hearings on the next slide?
Yeah, so one of the most significant changes in the LCIA rules 2020 is that both the request for arbitration and the response to the request must now be submitted electronically, unless hard copy has already been expressly approved either by, from one of the most significant changes. One of the most significant changes in the LCIA rules 2020 is that both the request for arbitration and the response to the request must now be submitted electronically unless hard copy has already been previously expressly approved by the LCIA registrar, acting on behalf of the LCIA court. And this requirement for electronic submission is set out in Article 1.3 of the rules in respect to the request, and Article 2.3 in relation to the response. And the rules provide Article 4.1 for this electronic submission to be done either through email or other electronic means, including any future electronic filing system operated by the LCIA. So other submissions and correspondence in relation to the arbitration must also now be communicated electronically, unless hard copy has already been expressly approved or ordered by the LCIA or the tribunal, and this is covered in Article 4.2. So under the LCIA rules 2020, electronic communication is now the default position throughout the arbitration. And this is a major change from the text of the LCIA rules 2014, which allowed hard copy submissions to be used without prior permission. Now, there is a practical point here, which is that where a claimant thinks that they are not going to be able to send that request for arbitration electronically because they don't have a functioning email address for the other party, then time is going to need to be allowed for them to obtain prior permission from the registrar to deliver the request in hard copy. And this is obviously going to be particularly important where limitation is a potential factor. So having said that, given that electronic submissions and communication have long been the norm in practice, on a day-to-day basis, these new provisions on electronic communication are unlikely to change most users' experience of LCIA arbitration. Moving on to awards, they can now be signed and distributed electronically, with Article 26.2 allowing signing in counterpart and assembly into one instrument unless the parties agree otherwise. Where an award is issued on paper and electronically as well, then to the extent that there are any differences between the paper and electronic copies of the award, then the electronic copies are now going to prevail under Article 6.7. And this is a change from the previous position under the LCIO rules 2014, where the paper award took precedence. So this move towards electronic awards is clearly a practical approach which has been pretty well received. Where parties anticipate that a paper copy award is going to be needed for enforcement purposes, perhaps to meet local requirements in certain jurisdictions, then they can make submissions to that effect to the tribunal and a paper award can still be issued. On hearings, Article 19 allows the tribunal to order that a hearing will be held virtually, either entirely remotely or part remotely, with a mixture of remote and in-person attendance. And the LCIO rules provide for a range of current and future technology to be used for this purpose, referring expansively to other communications technology.
And I expect these changes are reflective of emerging practice over the last few months.
Yes, absolutely. Because a lot of arbitration hearings, both institutional and ad hoc actually, have been going ahead virtually this year, with some going ahead entirely virtually, with all the different stakeholders in the arbitration joining remotely. And other hearings have gone ahead with some participants present in person and others attending remotely. So the institutions have actually responded very quickly to the pandemic, with the LCIA, among other institutions, introducing changes to their processing to enable cases to be filed virtually while their secretariat has been working remotely, and for parties and tribunals to communicate online. So early in the pandemic, there was of course a phase where many hearings were initially postponed. But then later on, there was a subsequent realization that unfortunately this might be a new normal globally for some time to come. And with that did come a greater willingness on the part of many tribunals and parties to start to embrace virtual hearings. So many LCIA hearings have actually obviously being heard virtually under the 2014 rules as a result of the pandemic. So really these new provisions in these 2020 rules expressly provide for what's already been happening in practice. So Craig, do you want to cover the next slide and move on to tribunal secretaries?
Certainly. Now, in arbitrations under the LCIA rules 2014, the tribunal secretary's role was not expressly addressed in the rules themselves. Instead, the provisions governing the use of tribunal secretaries were addressed in Section 8 of the LCIA's guidance note to arbitrators. The LCIA rules 2020 are now clear about the role of the tribunal secretary, and it's dealt with in the text of the rules themselves. Now, in the period since that last LCIA rule change 6 years ago, the role of the tribunal secretary in international arbitrations has become more formalised, and expectations around conflicts and the role of the tribunal secretary have become more consistent and perhaps more aligned with the expectations, certainly of the parties, but also of arbitrators. Now, I mentioned the LCIA guidance note to arbitrators a moment ago, and it's worth also reflecting upon the 2017 English High Court case of P versus Q, which highlighted the importance of the issue in practice. In that case, there was a failed application to remove, in effect, the entire LCIA tribunal on the grounds that too much work had been delegated to the tribunal secretary. And in the course of rejecting that application, the court reviewed the relevant provisions, both of the English Arbitration Act and the LCIA rules, and actually lent some judicial support to the approach taken by the LCIA to the appointment and employment of tribunal secretaries. Now, unsurprisingly, given the approach taken by the court in P versus Q, whilst the text in Article 14A is new to the rules, it's really just formalising the existing practice within LCIA arbitration and putting that into the rules themselves. And in particular, the provision makes clear that tribunal members must not delegate their decision-making powers to the tribunal secretary. That, of course, is absolutely critical. You cannot have a fourth member of the tribunal or a second member if you have a sole arbitrator. Of course, the parties must agree to the use of the tribunal secretary in the first place. Tribunal secretaries must also themselves disclose any conflicts of interest and must search those, as must an arbitrator. And finally, the obligation of confidentiality under Article 30 of the rules applies equally to the tribunal secretary. And that's something which the parties will see in writing at the outset.
So, summarising that then, Craig, in effect, the role of the tribunal secretary has been made a lot clearer in the new rules. And in fact, turning to the next slide, the same is true of the role of authorised representatives. So the RCIA's annex on council conduct was pretty groundbreaking and new to the 2014 rules. And this annex has actually been kept in the 2020 rules. But the wording of the updated provision now uses different language. So the annex is now referring to authorised representatives to clear up debate around the meaning of the provisions that were in the 2014 rules. So in Article 18 of the 1998 rules, it had been very clear that any party could choose to be represented either by counsel or by any other representative, whether that representative was legally qualified or not, including claims consultants. So in the 2014 rules, the language had shifted and was now referring to one or more authorised legal representatives, which has been leading to queries about whether party representation in LCIA arbitration was being restricted to lawyers. So the new wording in the 2014 rules now makes it crystal clear that parties can, of course, indeed be represented either by legally qualified or non-legally qualified individuals. And the new wording also, and very importantly, makes it clear that whether your party representative is a qualified lawyer or not, they still have to adhere to that important conduct set of provisions which are contained in the annex to the rules. So these include prohibitions on the use of false evidence, concealment of documents, false statements, or attempts to make unilateral contact with the tribunal.
Let's move on to the next slide and talk about changes to the provisions on nationality in relation to the appointment of a sole arbitrator or a presiding arbitrator. Now, under the 2020 LCIA rules, where the parties are of different nationalities, the sole or presiding arbitrator should not have the same nationality as any of the parties, unless the parties have agreed in writing that this should be permitted. Now, that was also the case under the 2014 rules, but the revised rules have introduced greater clarity to as to how nationality should be defined for these purposes, stating in Article 6.2 that this will be judged on the basis of citizenship, either by birth or naturalisation. Now, this is a helpful new provision in practice because it should deter unmeritorious challenges to arbitrators made on the basis that they have either cultural or professional links to particular jurisdictions. Now, greater clarity has also been provided under Article 6.2 on the assessment of the nationality of corporate entities, providing now that a company will be considered to be a national both of the country where it is incorporated and also where it has its effective seat of management. Now, on the next slide, we see another significant change, which is the introduction of composite requests. Where a party has claims under multiple contracts, the new rules provide for these to be brought more efficiently in one single composite request. Now, that was not possible under the 2014 rules, as the English High Court decided, as confirmed in 2017, in the case of A versus B, which confirmed that under the 2014 LCIA rules, a party was not permitted to commence a single arbitration where the dispute arose under separate contracts. Now, in that case, the claimant attempted to commence two arbitrations under two separate contracts for the sale of crude oil, each of which contained an LCIA arbitration agreement. But rather than use two separate requests, the claimant had attempted to commence both arbitrations simply by filing the one request and paying one, not two, registration fees. Now, the English High Court decided that under the old rules, that could not validly commence two separate proceedings. So under those rules, a claimant with claims under multiple contracts really needed to issue multiple separate requests for arbitration and then seek to have those separate proceedings consolidated later, where that was permissible. But under the new rules, Article 1.2 now allows a party to file a single composite request for arbitration and by doing so refer multiple disputes to arbitration in the same time. Now, it's important to be aware that this is a shortcut, but it doesn't deal with all of the complexities that may arise. It doesn't get rid of them, because a claimant serving a composite request must still meet the requirements set out in the rules in respect of each separate arbitration. So the composite request must separately identify the claim value, the relevant transaction or circumstances, the basis of the claim for each arbitration, as we would do now when commencing a case. And importantly, for the LCIA, the registration fee still needs to be paid separately for each separate arbitration, and using a composite request won't reduce the filing costs. So each arbitration commenced in the composite request will initially proceed separately, but of course, in appropriate cases, consolidation or at least concurrency in procedural terms may follow later. So as to that, it is possible to accompany the composite request with a request for consolidation, and in many cases that will be the appropriate step. But it's not automatically granted, and consolidation will of course be determined by the tribunal and or by the LCIA, depending on the stage of the proceeding. So it remains to be seen how the subsequent requests for consolidation will be treated in practice, and whether they will prove to be more frequently a formality rather than a genuine hurdle.
And so when you've filed that composite request, then presumably you might find that the respondent comes back to you on all those multiple arbitrations simultaneously in one response.
Yes, that's right, Rebecca. The respondent is entitled to respond by way of a composite response under Article 2.2, and in practice you would expect that would always be the most efficient way to respond to multiple arbitrations initiated under a composite request. But again, and as you would expect, we must be aware that there is a composite response. Again, the rules mandate that each and every requirement must be met in respect of each separate arbitration in terms of the substance of that response.
Yeah, and just staying with requests and responses actually for a moment. So there's another change in the LCIA rules which actually applies both to standard and composite requests and responses. So if we just move forward to the next slide. So in the interest of efficiency, the LCIA rules 2020 actually give the LCIA court a new power, which is the power to allow amendments to requests after they've been filed. So under Article 1.5, those amendments can be made after the commencement of the arbitration, but before the tribunal's been appointed. So this provision allows claimants to change the request to correct errors in computation, clerical errors, typographical errors, ambiguities, or what are described as mistakes of a similar nature. So as a safeguard, those amendments will only be allowed after all the parties have had a reasonable opportunity to state their views. And in terms of the response, the same power is also available under Article 5. So it's not yet clear how often those amendments are actually going to be sought in practice. And it's also not clear how often they're going to be permitted and what's going to be determined to fall within that ambiguities category. So Craig, just to pick back up on something that you mentioned in relation to composite requests, can we circle back a bit and could you tell us a bit more about what the new rules say on consolidation?
Yes, because I mentioned a moment ago that consolidation will not follow automatically simply because a composite request is used. And if we go to the next slide, we can take a closer look at the new consolidation provisions in the 2020 rules, which are very different from the regime that we've been used to under the 2014 rules. Under the old rules, there was provision for the parties to seek consolidation, and that was governed by Articles 22A and 22.6. But those provisions provided for a fairly restrictive approach to consolidation. Article 22.1, Roman numeral 10, and those rules only permitted a tribunal to consolidate arbitrations which had commenced either under the same arbitration agreement or under compatible arbitration agreements between the same disputing parties. And the LCIA court could only decide to consolidate two or more arbitrations subject to the LCIA rules where these had been commenced under the same arbitration agreement between the same disputing parties. And that was under Article 22.6. Now, there was an appetite amongst users for more extensive consolidation provisions, particularly where arbitration clauses are used in transactions involving multi-contract suites, such as finance transactions. Under the old rules, the only way to achieve and express, the only way to really to deal with this was to use bespoke drafting in order to establish an express consolidation framework where the parties to the relevant contracts were not identical under each document. And that could be a very complex task and sometimes with some opportunities to go awry whilst drafting up those complicated frameworks. But the new rules have made that less likely to arise and responded to user demand by significantly expanding the range of scenarios in which consolidation may be available.
And parties can actually apply to both the LCIA court and the tribunal for consolidation because under the LCIA rules 2020, there are two routes to consolidating. So let's start with the LCIA court under rule 22.8, which is up on the next slide. So the key point here is that the LCIA can only order consolidation itself where no arbitral tribunal has been formed for any of the arbitrations which are going to be being consolidated. So we're really talking here actually about right at the very beginning of the life of the arbitration and potentially where we've issued one of those composite requests. So the LCIA can order consolidation where all the parties to the arbitrations to be consolidated agree in writing. And that should include advance agreement by the parties in their arbitration agreement, if they've done that. And it would also include agreements in writing by all the parties to the arbitration after the dispute has arisen. And that is obviously going to happen where parties are all in agreement that their set of disputes is going to be dealt with most efficiently by simply consolidating them into one arbitration. So otherwise, where you've got the scenario that the parties are not in agreement about consolidation, the LCIA court can actually go ahead and order consolidation of arbitrations subject to the LCIA rules, having given the parties a reasonable opportunity to state their views, provided that the arbitrations have been commenced either under the same arbitration agreement or any compatible arbitration agreements between the same disputing parties, or where you've got compatible arbitration agreements even where the parties to those are not all the same, but where those arbitrations are arising out of either the same transaction or a series of related transactions. And so I've covered consolidation by the LCIA court, and I'm now going to hand over to Craig to cover consolidation by the tribunal once that tribunal has been formed.
And if we turn to the next slide, we will see that second route to consolidation, consolidation by the tribunal under Article 22.7 of the new rules. Now, this is a slightly different approach because the tribunal must give all of the parties an opportunity to state their views in respect of any form of consolidation, even where consolidation has been agreed in writing by the parties. That contrasts with the LCIA court route, which Rebecca described, where the parties need not be consulted if there has already been an agreement in writing. And no doubt that difference reflects the fact that under this route, the tribunal has already been formed. Now, again, consolidation may be ordered by the tribunal where all the parties have agreed in writing, which will include consolidation provisions in the arbitration clause itself. But it could also include an express written agreement entered into after the disputes have arisen. Now, otherwise, where the parties have not agreed to consolidation, the tribunal may order consolidation of arbitrations subject to the LCIA rules, provided that the arbitrations have been commenced either under the same arbitration agreement or alternatively any compatible arbitration agreements between the same disputing parties, or alternatively, again, compatible arbitration agreements even where the parties are not the same, but the arbitrations arise out of the same transaction or a series of related transactions. And in all cases, provided that no arbitral tribunal has yet been formed by the LCIA court for the other arbitration or arbitrations in question, or that the tribunals are in place and are all the same. So all of this means that the LCIA approach to consolidation now is very different to the approach under the 2014 rules. Now, it could potentially be argued that a range of arbitration agreements between different parties are compatible and arise out of the same transaction or related transactions. So that route is now open to you under the new rules, and that opens up opportunities for consolidation in a much wider set of circumstances than before, even where there is an absence of consolidation wording in the relevant contracts.
So we mentioned concurrency earlier on, so now is probably a good time to take a look at when that might be ordered, because there is a new provision at Article 22.73, which expressly permits a tribunal under the new LCIA Rules 2020 to order that arbitrations will be heard concurrently, where the same arbitral tribunal will then be constituted in each arbitration. So again, these arbitrations need to have been begun either under the same arbitration agreement or any compatible arbitration agreements between the same disputing parties, or compatible arbitration agreements even where they're not the same parties, but where the arbitrations are arising out of the same transaction or a series of related transactions. So we won't go into a huge amount of detail on concurrency today, but in practice, you are most likely to get concurrency either where the parties are all in agreement that the disputes are best dealt with by way of arbitrations proceeding concurrently, or in certain sectors where concurrency is already standard. So in maritime disputes, for example, concurrent arbitration is already fairly common. So examples of that are where you've got multiple parallel contracts. So for example, a set of shipbuilding contracts which have all been concluded by the same shipyard with different subsidiaries, but all within the same group of companies. And concurrent arbitrations are also very common where you've got cases involving long charter party chains. There are separate contracts between different parties, but those involve, all the arbitrations are involved similar or identical facts, and the contracts are either identical or near identical. So you can see in those circumstances why running those arbitrations concurrently makes eminent sense. So while the LCIA rules 2014 didn't actually make express reference to concurrency, in fact, concurrent proceedings in practice were already permitted under those rules and were already happening, even though they weren't expressly referred to. And that was actually recognised in the LCIA notes for arbitrators at section 6.3. So while the consolidation and concurrency provisions are quite broad under these new rules. Craig, we don't think consolidation is going to be ordered in every case?
Well, no, you're right. There is a broad scope to potentially hear related disputes together, but there are limits to the consolidation and concurrency provisions. And it's worth drawing out a few of the key restrictions or limitations to them. Firstly, where consolidation is requested on the basis of a series of related transactions, but one or more parties dispute the request to consolidate, the applying party will need to be able to make a convincing case that the transactions relate sufficiently closely and why the disputes should be heard together. It's also very clear that the new rules do not provide for consolidation of multiple arbitrations after those arbitrations are already underway with different tribunals in place. And it's important to be aware of this point, and it's an important practical point, because late applications for consolidation won't be entertained after separate tribunals have been constituted. So the timing is absolutely critical. And I think it is worth perhaps running through an example on this next slide to look at how the new consolidation provisions will work in practice. So in an energy construction project scenario, you'll have the main construction contract between the project owner and the main contractor. There might then be a number of separate subcontractors with a number of subcontractors. There might then be a number of separate subcontracts with a number of subcontractors. And there could, for example, be disputes arising under two of those subcontracts, each of whom will be with a different party. Now, where issues arise on the project that impact on all of these contracts, and separate arbitrations might arise under all three contracts, consolidation of all three arbitrations would not have been possible under the 2014 LCIA rules unless all of the parties expressly agreed. And that is simply because there is not an exact identity of the parties across all of the contracts. But under the 2020 rules, it would be open to the LCIA court to order consolidation of all of those proceedings, provided, again, that no tribunals had yet been formed. Alternatively, if a tribunal had been formed in one of them, that tribunal could order consolidation in respect of all of them, provided that the arbitrations in the arbitrations 2 and 3 had not yet seen a tribunal constituted. Now, that would be ordered on the basis that here we have a series of related transactions, of course, assuming that the arbitration agreements are compatible. So it's immediately clear why this new consolidation regime under the 2020 rules will be welcomed by parties to complex multi-contract projects, as this makes broader and more straightforward provision for disputes to be held together, to resolve them together, avoiding parallel proceedings, dealing with common issues, saving time and costs along the way. Now, another sector to consider is the financial sector, and financial institutions often value the opportunity to consolidate multi-contract disputes. Many banks were already using bespoke drafting to achieve consolidation to provide for it in forms which were wider or more broadly drawn than allowed by the provisions under the 2014 LCIA rules, and the broader consolidation provisions under these new rules will no doubt be well received by financial institutions. And of course, those institutions make up a significant proportion of the users of LCIA arbitration.
Yes, and while we're actually talking about potential practical scenarios like this, so again, on the practical note, in some circumstances, we anticipate that users would still want to expressly provide agreement to consolidation across related agreements, because it may now be possible, as in Craig's example, to get consolidation in place in these kinds of scenarios without express drafting. but where you've got an incredibly complex and very high value multi-contract transaction, some parties are still going to see a strong reason for using express wording to essentially maximise the likelihood that that consolidation is going to be available to them. And equally, on the other side of the coin, there will also potentially be other parties who might want to avoid consolidation for a variety of commercial reasons. And those parties are potentially going to be seeking to use express drafting to contract out of that very wide consolidation framework, which has been provided by the new rule.
Yes, let's move on to the next slide and look at another area of significant textual change in the new rules, which is in relation to the conduct of proceedings and additional powers, because there have been major amendments to Article 14 and Article 22 in the 2020 rules. Now, whilst the drafting may be new, the powers described and addressed are not in fact necessarily new. On one view, the sections simply expressly confirm powers which the tribunal already had under the LCIA rules. But it's my understanding that the objective is perhaps not to come up with new powers and so on, but to encourage the exercise of the important powers that tribunals in LCIA or arbitrations already possess, but which perhaps have not always been used. So in Article 14, there's some shuffling of the text, but the general duties of the tribunal have not been changed. And Article 14 continues to make it clear the tribunal has the widest discretion available to it to discharge those general duties. Now, the new wording of Article 14.5 and 14.6 sets out some of the powers that fall into this widest discretion. And the wording clarifies that the tribunal may shorten timescales, limit evidence, restrict written submissions, and use suitable technology to enhance efficiency. And such these wide powers drawn in these clear terms should enable the tribunal to effectively put in place a bespoke expedited procedure for cases where that might be appropriate. And as for Article 15, well, that confirms the tribunal's overall control of the written procedure, its extent, and its timescales.
Yeah, so the new rules emphasise the breadth of the tribunal's discretion. And in fact, that now extends to summary dismissal, which we mentioned earlier. So as we've set out on the next slide, there is a new express provision now in the rules for summary dismissal, which is at Article 22.18. So this new wording allows the tribunal to dispose of any claim, defence, counterclaim, cross-claim, defence to counterclaim, or defence to cross-claim on the basis that that is either manifestly outside the jurisdiction of the arbitral tribunal, or inadmissible, or manifestly without merit. So this wording is very much in line with the provisions for early determination that we've already seen in other institutional rules. So for example, the SEAC rules and the HKIC rules. And we've also had confirmation from the ICC that this power is actually available under the ICC rules as well. So the LCIA rules don't set out any detailed procedure for how this early determination process is actually going to be conducted. So instead, that is left to the discretion of the tribunal. And arguably that makes really good practical sense, because the tribunal are going to be best placed to decide the most appropriate process in any given case. So quite a number of commentators have also been pointing out that the meaning of manifestly without merit also isn't set out in the rules. Now that is true, but in fact, the wording is very similar to the SEAC rules, where an application for early dismissal is going to be sustainable, where the relevant claim or defence is, and they use the wording, manifestly without legal merit. So obviously that's very, very similar wording. So this threshold isn't defined in the SEAC rules either, But the wording in the SEAC rules was derived from the earlier Rule 41.5 of the ICSID rules, and there's been quite a lot of ICSID cases on this, so we're not entirely in the dark there. So a number of the ICSID cases have considered the meaning of manifestly without legal merit, and they've acknowledged that this is a pretty high threshold to meet. So in order to get over that threshold and get the case thrown out on that basis, the applicant needs to show, certainly according to the ICSID case law, that the claim in question is clearly and unequivocally unmeritorious, and not those which are novel, difficult, refer to disputed legal issues, or where the claimant has a tenable or arguable case. So that was the wording that was set out in the ICSID case of Lyon, Mexico, against the United Mexican States. So while it does remain to be seen how this wording is actually going to be interpreted by the LCIA tribunals in practice, in fact, the early determination provision is probably going to further enhance the appeal of the LCIA to financial institutions, many of which we've heard have in practice sometimes wanted to use the English courts in the past for contracts due to the availability of summary judgment. So the new early determination provisions are expected to be of particular interest to those potential LCIA users. The rules also retain the powers of emergency arbitrators. So emergency arbitration was included in the LCIA rules for the first time in the 2014 rules. So as we can see on this next slide, in the new rules, the LCIA have clarified and also somewhat expanded, in fact, the emergency arbitrator's powers. So there have been some minor changes to the powers of emergency arbitrators, and those are at Article 9B. So emergency arbitrators are now able to decide the recoverable legal costs arising out of the emergency proceedings. And they're also able to decide how those and the arbitration costs in relation to the emergency proceedings should be allocated as between the parties. So this is a really welcome new provision, because what that means is that parties who've gone through emergency arbitration are now going to be able to try to get recovery of those costs of the emergency proceedings at this stage of the arbitration, rather than needing to wait till later in the process. So under the LCIA rules 2020, the emergency arbitrator also now has the power to vary and discharge his or her orders, and can also make an additional award in relation to any claim for emergency relief that had been put forward in the arbitral proceedings but hadn't yet been decided in an existing award of the emergency arbitrator. So Craig, it's probably a good time to move on to the related subject of the amended provisions on interim relief on the next slide.
Yes, and this is another interesting area of change, because these provisions have enhanced the party's ability to apply for urgent interim relief at the very start of the arbitration process. The old rules stated at Article 9B that the availability of an emergency arbitrator shall not prejudice any party's right to apply to a state court for interim measures before the formation of the tribunal, and that the emergency arbitrator provision shall not be treated as an alternative to or as a substitute for the exercise of that right to apply to a state court. But in 2016, the perhaps surprising English High Court judgment in the Gerald Metals case threw into doubt the availability of interim relief under the LCIA rules. In that case, the court rejected an application for a freezing injunction in support of LCIA arbitration. The court considered the requirement of urgency under Section 44.3 of the Arbitration Act 1996, which empowers the court to make orders which it considers necessary to preserve evidence or assets where the case is one of urgency. Now, the court considered that urgency requirement in the Gerald Metals case, and they found that it would only be met where the matter was so urgent that there was insufficient time to form an expedited tribunal or to appoint an emergency arbitrator, or where an expedited tribunal or an emergency arbitrator could not exercise the necessary powers. But if an expedited tribunal could be constituted, or an emergency arbitrator could be appointed within the relevant timeframe, and the expedited tribunal or emergency arbitrator could then practically exercise the necessary powers, then it followed that the test of urgency under the Act would not be satisfied and the court would not have power to grant urgent relief. Now, the court adopted that approach, notwithstanding the wording in Article 9.12 of the LCIA Rules 2014, and the High Court said that this did not prevent the powers of the court from being limited as a result of the existence of Article 9b. Now, the LCIA has introduced some amendments in response to that case, making minor changes to the old Article 9.12, now found in Article 9.13, and to Article 25.3, which addresses interim relief before the arbitral tribunal in a more general sense. And what we see is a simplification of the language and the availability of court-ordered interim relief in certain circumstances is confirmed. But, of course, ultimately, it remains up to the court to decide how to interpret the operation of the Arbitration Act in the context of the parties' agreement to arbitrate under the LCIA rules. So, in the light of that, ultimately, there is little room for the LCIA to clarify things much further. It's a matter for the court to address and rule upon. And it remains to be seen how the court will operate in relation to the application for interim relief in future cases which are commenced under the LCIA rules.
So just turning to the next slide now and moving on to changes to timescales. So in the interests of efficiency primarily, some timescales have now been reduced under the 2020 rules, though it'll be a relief to everyone to hear that these changes are actually fairly minor. So the new rules provide for a 28-day rather than a 35-day period in which the LCIA will appoint the tribunal under Article 5.8. Under Article 14.3, the parties in the tribunal now have to make contact within 21 days of notice of constitution of the tribunal. So the timing was the same under the 2014 rules. It still referred to 21 days, but this contact was encouraged, whereas now it's actually mandatory. So the language of the 2020 rules has shifted across to make this a requirement. Actually, this kind of early contact between the parties has always been best practice in any event. So the rules confirm that the required contact here can be achieved either by an in-person or a virtual meeting or by exchange of correspondence. So we're not talking about a particularly onerous requirement, just something which makes good practical sense. So moving on to Article 15.10, there's a new requirement in the rules for the tribunal to try to produce the award no more than 3 months after the final submissions, whether those are written or oral. So this is actually unlikely to make a significant change to the way that LCIA arbitrations actually proceed, because it in fact reflects the reported current median time for the production of LCIA awards at the moment. So it's just tidy to have that in there, but it isn't going to be a huge change. And so we mentioned earlier that there are new provisions on both data protection and cybersecurity. So Craig, did you want to add a bit more about those provisions?
Yes, if we turn to the next slide, we see that the 2020 rules now, for the first time for the LCIA, address data protection and cybersecurity, both of which, of course, are increasingly hot topics in international arbitration. Now, personal data is necessarily included in a range of documents in international arbitration proceedings, whether in written submissions, witness statements, and expert reports. And given the potentially significant sanctions for breaching the EU's General Data Protection Regulation, the GDPR, and other relevant data protection legislation, it's important that institutions, tribunals, and parties are aware of the importance of compliance. Now, at the same time, an awareness of the cybersecurity risk has also grown, and there is widespread acknowledgement that the arbitral process has the potential to be a target for hackers, whether motivated by financial gain, by activism, or for other motivations. So with all of that in mind, it's unsurprising to see the LCIA deciding to address these issues expressly in the 2020 rules. Now, the LCIA is still the first leading arbitral institution to make express provision for data protection within its rules, and we'd expect to see other institutions introduce similar provisions and follow suit in the future. So what we find in the LCIA rules now may be a good indicator of the future direction of travel for arbitration as a whole. And we see, for example, at Article 30.4 of the rules, an acknowledgement by the LCIA that any processing of personal data by the LCIA is subject to applicable data protection legislation. And we see also reference in that article to the data protection notice on the LCIA website, which recognises that the LCIA will be the data controller in relation to personal data provided to the LCIA itself. And it also sets out how personal data will be collected and processed by the LCIA. Interestingly, there are also new express requirements for tribunals to take into account data protection in arbitrations which are commenced on or after the 1st of October 2020. And in particular, Article 30.5 requires tribunals to consult with the parties, and where appropriate, also the LCIA, in order to decide whether to adopt any specific security measures to protect information shared in the arbitration, and whether there are any particular measures required to address the processing of personal data. And the rules make clear that consultation by the tribunal should occur at an early stage, as it's put, of the arbitration. Now, under Article 30.6, both the LCIA and the tribunal may issue directions on information security or data protection, which will bind the parties subject to any mandatory legal provisions. And in the case of directions from the LCIA, those directions will also bind the tribunal, again, subject, of course, to any mandatory legal provisions.
So there's also been a strengthening of the confidentiality provisions that apply to LCIA arbitration, and those are set out on the next slide. So the express confidentiality provision that was in the 2014 rules, which was at Article 30.1, set a requirement for all arbitral awards to be kept confidential, together with all the materials that have been produced in the arbitration, along with documents produced in the arbitration that weren't already public, and that was subject to certain limited exceptions. Now, there is a new and additional requirement in Article 30.1 of the new rules, which requires each party to seek this same undertaking of confidentiality from all third parties that that particular party involves in the arbitral proceedings. So this is stated to include their authorised representatives, their witnesses of fact, their expert witnesses, and any service providers. So you can see that that's going to cover potentially quite a wide range of third parties, including third-party funders, transcribers, translators, and those companies that are providing virtual hearing platforms. So the same confidentiality undertaking now also applies to the tribunal, to the tribunal secretary, and to any tribunal appointed expert. So Craig, should we move on to the next slide and the new compliance provision?
Yes, and as you say, Rebecca, compliance considerations are covered for the first time in the new rules, and that includes compliance with the international sanctions regime, with anti-corruption measures, tax law, and the anti-money laundering legislation. So the new rules provide expressly at Article 24A that any dealings between parties to arbitral proceedings in the LCIA will be subject to any applicable regulatory requirements. And the rules expressly state in this context that the LCIA will refuse to answer instructions or to make any payments where the LCIA considers that this will amount to prohibited activity, breach the law, or expose the LCIA to censure from regulators or law enforcement agencies. Under Article 24.11, the parties are required to give the LCIA any documents or information that the LCIA may reasonably request in order to comply with relevant legislation. And the LCIA also confirms that it will disclose both information and documents if necessary to the courts, law enforcement agencies, and to regulatory authorities. So, whilst the new provision does not, of course, alter the substantive existing compliance obligations of either the LCIA or the parties themselves under applicable legislation, it's fair to say that practitioners will likely welcome the inclusion of a clear framework for dealing with any compliance concerns that may arise in the course of an arbitration.
We also mentioned earlier that there are some changes to the cost regime. So as you can see from the next slide, there have been some small changes made to the schedule of costs in this update to the rules. So in terms of administrative charges, the registration fee in arbitrations under the LCIA rules 2020 has undergone a moderate increase and is going to rise from £1,750 to £1,950. And turning to the maximum hourly fees for the tribunal, those have increased from £450 per hour under the 2014 rules to £500 per hour under the 2020 rules to accommodate the most complex cases. And the LCIA has also changed its approach to the advance payments of the costs made by parties which were previously held on trust. So as under the 2014 rules, under the 2020 rules, the LCIA court can direct parties to make advance payments of costs. But under Article 24 of the new rules, the LCIA is no longer going to be holding those on trust under English law, but they will be the property of the LCIA once they're paid over, with a proviso that at the conclusion of the arbitration, any excess that remains with the LCIA is going to be returned to the parties. And this change is really primarily an internal matter for the LCIA, and it isn't really going to impact on the way that LCIA arbitrations are run. So Craig, before we finish, I think you wanted to highlight one final change, which is the new provision in relation to the interpretation of the rules themselves.
Yes, Rebecca, and we deal with this on the next slide. And Article 16.5 is new, and the LCIA rules now state for the first time that they must be interpreted in accordance with English law. So this is a provision which is aiming to introduce certainty and consistency in respect of how the rules themselves will be interpreted. And that will primarily be relevant in circumstances either where the arbitration is seated outside London or where the arbitration agreement is not governed by English law. Now, the rules maintain the previous provisions in relation to the seat and the governing law of the arbitration. And as before, and as one would expect, the parties are free to choose any seat they wish to agree. But under Article 16.2, if no seat is chosen, the default seat of arbitration for LCIA matters will continue to be London. Now, the LCIA rules in 2014 introduced an express provision that the law governing the arbitration agreement will be the law of the seat of arbitration unless the parties have made a different choice. That approach has been retained in the 2020 rules, and you could say that it's now particularly topical as a point following the Supreme Court decision in the Enka v. Chubb case in October 2020. Which will now, we expect, become the leading authority under English law of which law will govern the arbitration agreement. Now, that decision arose from a contract where there was no express choice of law made to govern the arbitration agreement itself, and there was no choice of law for the main contract either. Now, that case involved arbitration under the ICC rules, not the LCIA rules, but it reconfirmed that the parties are free to make an express choice of governing law for the arbitration agreement, and the same principle will of course apply across arbitrations in general, not only ICC arbitrations. Now, in LCIA arbitrations, unless the parties opt for a different governing law for the arbitration agreement, they will be considered to have chosen the law of the seat to govern the arbitration agreement itself. And we believe this is, of course, a useful provision because it promotes certainty and it should avoid the difficult questions that arose in the Enka v. Chubb case on those particular facts.
Thanks, Craig. So having gone through that quick run through the main changes that we all need to be aware of, it really only remains for us to take a step back and to look in our final slide at the rules themselves and where all this leaves us. So the new rules are clearly more modern, more flexible, and they're certainly clearer. It's going to be interesting to see how the rules are actually used and how they're interpreted in practice going forward. So for example, it really remains to be seen whether the trend towards virtual arbitration that we've all seen recently in the course of the pandemic is going to significantly accelerate in the lifetime of this new edition of the rules.
Well, that's right. And given the potential cost savings and also the sustainability benefits of conducting arbitration hearings virtually rather than in person, it might well be that this is a shift that lasts, this trend towards virtual hearings. But of course, it's likely too early to say definitively. On a different point, whilst the LCIA rules give the arbitrators a very wide latitude to design a dispute resolution procedure which is suitable for a particular case, whether or not the powers are actually used, that is of course a matter for the tribunals and for counsel to become comfortable with that, for parties to encourage that, and we'll see if these powers, these new powers and the reference to existing powers in a more explicit way will encourage their uptake. And it's also, of course, at this stage unclear how the courts will approach tweaks in the interim relief wording and what type of practical impact that may have. Now, some commentators have rightly pointed out the need for careful thought about potential enforcement jurisdictions, given the shift to electronic communications and awards. And in some jurisdictions, it will remain the case that there might be formal rules requiring hard copy notice of the arbitration to be given, for example, along with requirements for the awards to be in hard copy. And it may well be that not every jurisdiction is as relaxed about the shift to soft copies, and that could trip parties up when it gets to the enforcement stage of arbitrations. And then finally, one point to draw out whilst we are looking into the crystal ball. And there have already been a number of queries raised about composite requests, in particular in relation to confidentiality concerns which might arise in relation to composite requests, and also as to whether this will truly provide an administrative benefit in practice. So plenty to look at in the coming period to see how these rules bed down and how they're used.
Well, a lot of stuff. I'm sorry we've gone slightly over, but there's so much material, and I didn't want to stop our two great speakers, Rebecca and Craig, in full flow. Do appreciate that this is archived and you can watch it on demand. Also, there is a multiple choice quiz so that you can ensure that you've comprehended all that you've learned, and that will, of course, satisfy SRA requirements too. So thank you for joining us, and I very much hope you can join us on our next occasion in the studio, hopefully. Thank you.